Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. It's another double feature this week. I've chosen a pair of episodes that were produced by Ken Lane right around this time of year. The first episode is Graham Parsons and the Phoenix Lights from July 17, 2017. The second is The Witch's Beat from July 14, 2023. Enjoy!
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the Mojave Desert, and it's a real hot night. Well, it's a real nice night for driving around and across these desert lands. With your radio on, your eyes open for jackrabbits, coyotes, bobcats, mule deer, bighorn sheep, desert tortoise, feral burros, hitchhikers. Those guys walking on the side of the road with a wooden cross on their shoulder with a wheel on the bottom. The wheel is cheating. And there's that immense sky all around you and that big yellow moon to the southeast. You get out and you walk around a little. You notice bats here and there in the warm summer air. You notice it feels a little humid out because we're coming up on monsoon season. That's when the swamp coolers stop working. And something big goes by. You feel the wind on the back of your neck, and then you see the owl swooping low, and you can almost see it settling on a branch of a Joshua tree about 100 yards to your left. Some nights you might see some helicopters from the Marine base flying low with all their lights off. If you're inside, the house will start to shake. Get out the cabin and look up in the sky, and they're already gone. You might see that one red light blinking in the distance. And sometimes you see something you can't explain at all. And every now and again, you might be lucky enough to see something that a whole lot of other people saw at the same time, and that cannot be easily explained. Twenty years ago, from the eastern end of the Mojave Desert and across the Sonoran Desert from Arizona to Mexico, thousands of people saw what they believed to be an invasion from the skies. It was March of 1997, the 13th. The key witness to 1997's Phoenix Lights events was Arizona's governor at the time, Fife Symington. Now, he saw what he called an enormous silent black triangle, It passed overhead at low altitude on the night of March 13th. It just felt otherworldly, Symington told CNN. Now, Symington was in his second term when thousands of people across Nevada to Arizona to the Mexican state of Sonora reported seeing massive, silent craft looming over highway traffic, hovering over small desert towns, and especially over the vast Phoenix metropolitan area. But Governor Symington did not tell the national media about his otherworldly sighting until a decade later, by which time he was out of politics and immune to public scorn. As a former Air Force captain, Symington could have added tremendously to the credibility of the eyewitness pool. And his report may have offered comfort to the vast numbers of Arizona's citizens who saw ominous things floating slowly overhead that night. Instead, after weeks of increasing hysteria and a surge of national press coverage, Symington called reporters to the state capitol at Phoenix and played a prank on them. With television crews broadcasting the press conference to both local news stations and CNN, Symington solemnly declared that state officials had found who was responsible for the panic. And then his security detail brought out the alien in the form of Symington's chief of staff in a cheap Halloween costume. There were a few forced chuckles from the press. The national correspondents quickly gathered their things and headed home. The coverage was over. The mystery remained. When asked why he withheld his own sighting for 10 years and instead ridiculed those who admitted seeing the craft, Symington blamed his own panic, and he said he wanted to deflate lingering unease that he feared might escalate into a total breakdown of society. As a public figure, he told CNN in 2007, you have to be very careful what you say because people can have pretty emotional reactions. Symington now claims that he did his best to solve the riddle in the skies, but the commanders at Arizona's military air bases told him they were as, quote, perplexed as the other witnesses. The triangle was first seen in the Las Vegas suburb of Henderson, not far from the Groom Lake test sites known as Area 51. Witnesses next saw the mysterious ship over the Prescott Valley, and then it began its widely seen northwest to southeast crossing over Phoenix and the desert beyond, and was last reported over Sonora, Mexico. A second event, which was later explained as military flares released over the Estrella Mountains south of Phoenix, began more than an hour after the large triangular craft had crossed the sprawling city and suburbs. As word of the sighting spread by word of mouth and local media, throngs of people went outside to search the night sky for mysterious lights. And they were rewarded with a string of fizzling golden orbs, familiar to anyone who lives within view of a southwestern military base. The easily explained flares were conflated with reports of the giant crafts. The governor paraded a Halloween-costumed employee before the assembled media, and the Phoenix lights became another part of American folklore to be endlessly rehashed by the cheaply made paranormal documentaries that long ago replaced historical films on cable television. As for the black triangles, often seen hovering over desert highways to this day, They are usually said to be secret military aircraft. Why they are so brightly lit and flown so regularly over roads and towns for decades now is a mystery that has never had a satisfactory explanation. But if you travel the old Mojave Road along Mannix Wash, just west of Afton Canyon, on the edge of Mojave National Preserve in California, you'll find similar black triangles upon the scorched Rocky Mesa just above the historic trail. These dark triangles are geoglyphs, or intaglios, made long ago by those who traveled this ancient highway. When you head up to the high desert from Los Angeles or Palm Springs, you ascend State Highway 62, which twists and turns up a boulder-walled canyon until you're over the hump and rolling into Morongo Valley, home of the Sand to Snow National Monument that stretches from the top of San Gorgonio to the Joshua Tree Wilderness, with Big Morongo Canyon Preserve in between. There's the big yellow sign for the Cactus Mart, too. And that's your sign that you're officially in the high desert. We paid a visit to Nicole Holland, owner of the Cactus Mart.
My grandfather left Detroit, Michigan, and moved to Landers and homesteaded in a little tiny cabin out there off of Ritchie Road, I'd say in the late 60s, early 70s. So as a kid, we would come out here for summer break and visit. And so we've been coming out here since then, when it was really nothing going on in the 80s. And then we finally moved all the way out here in 91 and took care of them. So yeah, we've been out here a long time. I love it. In my early 20s, I started working in landscape construction in the low desert. And that was my background. We were building golf courses and working in country clubs and doing new model construction in the landscape design field, which I love. I love plants. I've always been driven towards plants. I don't know why. I don't know where exactly it comes from. Probably from being in the desert and you just, you know, you have sunshine 350 days a year. Everything will grow. Everything is always in bloom. You know, there's always a blooming season at some point in the desert, whether it's winter blooms, summer blooms, spring blooms. There's always something blooming in the desert, and I was always gravitated towards that. So when I had an opportunity to start with a landscape construction business in the low desert, I was probably like 23 or 24 years old. I took it. You know, you realize as you get a little bit older, you're developing land that probably shouldn't have been developed. You know, and there was a bit of an ignorance there in my younger days. So I started realizing I wasn't really fond of us ripping out beautiful land for a golf course. One day, I was living here. I moved here to town in Morongo back in like 2008. And I always came to the Cactus Mart. It's Cactus Mart's been around forever. It's been around since the 60s. Everybody knew Cactus Mart, and I was a local, and I shopped here, and I enjoyed it. And the owners knew me, and they knew I lived in town, and they were getting ready to want to retire. We discussed it, and it just kind of fit. It just, everything fell together and fell to place, and I got to buy the beloved Cactus Mart. And it was super, really exciting. I was really grateful. I got to do something now that made more sense for me, to actually work with plants that mean something, that are bringing the birds and bringing the monarch butterfly garden that we planted and educating people. And it's a whole different feeling than when you're just landscaping for aesthetics. Now you're landscaping for a purpose. Since I can remember, since I've been coming out here, the high desert has always been very mindful of their environment. They're not wasteful. They really aren't. I really don't go to very many houses that have lawns. The desert is full of color. All the plants have beautiful colors. And the smells, you know, the sage smells. People are drawn to that. And cactus alone. You walk through and you see just an ordinary looking cactus. And then it has this giant bloom coming off of it. And it's amazing, you know, and then you have the bees that gravitate towards it. And then you have our chickens and the cats and everyone adores the cats, the store cats. Butch and Sundance are about 6 years old now. Someone brought them into the store and everybody got adopted out except for Butch and Sundance. Can you even believe that? And they became the store cats. The chickens help with insects. Anytime you move a pot or you move a tree, they're right on it. They're right on it. They're there cleaning up the insects around it. They're amazing. They're amazing. Okay, as a child, I had a love-hate relationship with the desert. Probably like anybody in the 80s growing up out here. There wasn't much for us to do. We lived out, you know, when we were staying out in Landers, there really wasn't much to do. And driving Old Woman Springs Road, I would always get car sick. You know, and you're in the heat, you're not used to that kind of heat and stuff. So I really wasn't truly fond of the desert growing up as a child until I got into my later teens and early 20s. Then you start realizing the desert is such a beautiful place. I get to live here. So, and I get reminded of that every week when people are out here vacationing to remind me that I live in a place where people pay to come and stay for a week. We have to live within the desert. We don't adjust the desert to our needs. That's how I feel about it. I mean, there does need to be, you know, a certain amount of respect shown for the desert and the wildlife. And definitely out here, you can buy a lot of land and you can get definitely, you know, weird out here if you wanted to. My name is Nicole Holland. I live here in Morongo Valley, and I am the owner of the Cactus Mart.
And now it's time for the Desert Oracle mailbag. Jeff Callahan writes from Flat Rock, North Carolina. What's the deal with Joshua Tree and Graham Parsons? Well, Jeff, it's a long story, but I'll tell you the short version. Graham Parsons was a holy fool, one of those rare and exasperating characters who bring beauty and grace to the world, but must pay for this through buffoonery and self-destruction. There is usually heartbreak at the root of such stories, and that was very much the case with Ingram Cecil Connor III. Born to charming and wealthy and hard-drinking southern gentry. His father committed suicide when Graham was just a boy of 12 years old. His mother remarried. Graham took his stepfather's last name, Parsons. And then his mother died from the bottle 6 years later, the very day that Graham graduated from high school. By this time, he had performed music for many years, trying everything from Sun Records-style rockabilly to folk groups inspired by the Kingston Trio. At Harvard, where he was supposed to be studying theology, he discovered LSD and Merle Haggard. Graham Parsons moved to Los Angeles, and he began playing country-western music. And then he wound up joining the jangly folk rock group The Byrds, before forming the Flying Burrito Brothers. He and Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones had become fast friends, and they would spend time in a speck of a town called Joshua Tree. They liked to get drunk at the Winner's Circle Bar, where Crossroads Cafe is today, and they were fond of sitting atop Cap Rock in the National Monument in an old barber's chair that they dragged up there. The better to watch the skies for UFOs. Parsons returned to Joshua Tree many times over the next few years, and he occasionally took a break from drugs and liquor to make some beautiful music. which was mostly ignored by the pop audience of the day, but it inspired a brand of rock and roll influenced by Southern soul and Bakersfield country. Now, Grant Parsons finally made a solo album worthy of his talents, and he celebrated this with another visit to Joshua Tree. That's when he died, in room number 8 of the Joshua Tree Inn, on the night of September 18th, 1973. He was 26 years old. Just 2 months prior, Parsons attended the funeral of his friend and fellow musician, Clarence White, who had been killed by a truck driver in Palmdale in the West Mojave. At the funeral, Parsons made it known that when his time was up, he hoped that Joshua Tree National Monument would be his final resting place. It didn't quite work out that way, although it was attempted. His corpse was stolen from the airport in Los Angeles, and his friends tried to cremate his body at Cap Rock, although his half-burnt remains were eventually returned to his stepfather, who insisted that Parsons be buried in New Orleans, where Parsons had never even lived. Anyway, that's why Grant Parsons is forever associated with Joshua Tree. Well, now that the sun has set, it's not quite so hot out here. It's 94. It's a little humid. You see that there? That's a tortoise burrow. Read in the news last week that the tortoises being moved for the expansion of the Marine Corps base won't mate anymore. They've been traumatized. Here's an idea. Don't move the tortoises. Leave them where they are. Let's go up here. Another one of these illegal campfire rings we're always clearing. Oh, look, some new graffiti. I kind of think the devil might want some literate followers, don't you think? Should be able to spell. You need to spell before you can do spells. I realize that is unfair to pagans. That's why I don't say such things in polite company. Polite pagan company. Yeah, what's that guy doing driving up here? And we caught a couple of bozos up here the other day. They claimed they were working for Caltrans. So after work, they figured they'd just drive into a nature preserve. On to the boulders. After doing donuts and the dirt road. Grown men. Physically, anyway. Now, take a look here, on your right. All these little wooden stakes seem to be about every 6 or 8 feet. Fairly randomly spaced, as far as I can tell. Now, a few months ago, there were a couple of, goth kids out here. And they were taking pictures of these wooden stakes in the dirt. I asked them why, and they said for Instagram. I said, you know, they're just 6-inch pieces of wood. One of them looked at me and said, that's the same size as vampire steaks. But we welcome everyone here, as long as you don't drive your trucks onto the boulders. Now we'll just cross through the wash here. And I do advise you to be mindful of the rattlesnakes. Hard to see at night. Let's make our announcements, because we are coming to the end of another week of Desert Oracle Radio, and we do very much appreciate you listening and tuning in on Z107.7 FM in the high desert, and for subscribing to the podcast of the broadcast on iTunes. Just search for Desert Oracle Radio and you click the button that says subscribe. Every week you'll get the new episode. It'll just appear on your phone like a ghost. Desert Oracle Radio is brought to you by Desert Oracle, the pocket-sized field guide to the vast and intriguing American desert. You can subscribe to this as well, but this will cost you $25, money well spent. Send a check or money order to Desert Oracle, Post Office Box 1735, Joshua Tree, California. You can also subscribe at the website. It is called DesertOracle.com. We also keep a list of the music that we use on the broadcast. Speaking of, our theme music was composed by Pierre G. Langer. If you find yourself feeling a little drained by the heat, take solace. The autumn is only 88 days away. And then about a month or so after that, it'll start to cool down. Remember, summer is the annual price of admission for living in the desert. And we will be back next Friday at 10 p.m. You can write to us. The email address is radio@desertoracle.com. Remember to drink plenty of water. Make sure your dogs have plenty of water. Try to keep the scorpions outside where they belong. And good night from the voice of the desert.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. It's the time of the year when the heat cooks your brain. Nobody should ever have to make a serious decision when it's over 100 degrees. Nobody should be required to think at all. It's just too hot. Wait till it cools down before you make any big decisions. Like, I wonder if I should get up at all. maybe just stay inside, close to the swamp cooler, get the bed arranged precisely within the air conditioner's vent path. Let nothing impede the flow of the cold stuff. I look at my mini-split AC, and I understand in my heart that it's never going to get that room cool enough in desert summertime. So I'll just see how far it goes down on the liquid crystal display on the plastic controller that's always either out of batteries or has vanished entirely from this dimension. But while it's here and while it's working, how low will it go? 64? There's never going to be 64 in this room again, not until mid-October at 3 a.m. But sure, let's set it to 64 degrees. We can all pretend together. If you come out at all, you can be like Elvis Presley in Palm Springs. The most famous man in the world, aluminum foil in all his windows. Something I saw in the Hollywood Trade publication Deadline. The end game is to allow things to drag on until union members start losing their apartments and losing their homes, a studio executive told Deadline. Acknowledging the cold as ice approach, several other sources reiterated the statement. One insider called it, quote, a cruel but necessary evil. You know, if I had 30 or 40 or $500 million and a very visible mansion in Los Angeles, I probably would not want to say those things, even anonymously. This is Desert Oracle Radio. Back in 2015, not long after the first issue of Desert Oracle was published, a Los Angeles Times reporter named Deborah Netburn wrote to me saying she wanted to do a feature story. I thought about it for a day or two, and then I remembered a very realistic, a very romantic dream I'd had about the desert during a very cold and gloomy winter in Prague in the early 1990s. In this dream, I lived in some remote part of the Mojave Desert in brightest early springtime, and while it wasn't apparent what I did there, and it's still not, it involved a lot of my favorite things, driving along desert two lanes, typing and reading and recording in a little studio behind the house surrounded by Joshua trees, etc., all very evocative. And I wrote it all down in my notebook when I woke up in freezing cold Central Europe. One part of the dream I recalled with clarity was doing this interview with a reporter from, I think, a magazine. I'd met the reporter at a truck stop, and we were driving around the desert for unknown purposes, but it stuck in my mind. So when I got this email from Deborah Netburn at the LA Times, I put it together and I realized that dream from 1992 was a view of my own future, still decades away, So I wrote back and said, yeah, let's meet at a diner on the highway and drive around while I deliver desert oracles to these various stops in the Mojave. I did not mention the prophetic dream part because I did not yet know Deborah Netburn. But she liked the idea for the story. She brought along the terrific photographer, Rick Loomis. And it was an enjoyable day, not least because both of them loved the Mojave and the Joshua Tree area in particular, which was not nearly as common a sentiment 9 years ago as it is today. And in the years since, I've learned that Deborah Netburn welcomes conversations about prophetic dreams, about ancient and modern concepts of God and religion, about magic and divination, and of course, about the publishing and periodical business we've both been tied up with for our whole lives. But tonight is the first time she has been on the radio program, so welcome Deborah Netburn to Desert Oracle Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for sharing the story about the prophetic dream. That's the first I've heard of it.
I never told you that?
No. I'm like grinning here in my room. I love that.
Yeah, that was a real thing. I even located the notebook at some point. I've since lost it again, but it sort of clicked a few days after you'd sent me an email. And I thought, well, I guess there was some direction to all of this.
Yeah, I'm just thrilled to be part of a prophetic dream and experience. That might be my first one, so thanks.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for, what do they call it, manifesting it.
Right. Oh, we had a really good time. I love that story. I love doing that story.
That was the first in-person interview I'd done regarding Desert Oracle, and that's still my favorite article. You have now been a part-time resident for many years.
Yeah.
Rick Loomis said that he would come out here with a group of rock climbers going back to the 90s, so
I
felt very comfortable. Let me read your current biography from the newspaper. It says, Deborah Netburn covers faith, spirituality, and joy for the Los Angeles Times. She started at the Times in 2006 and has worked across a wide range of sections, including entertainment, home and garden, national news, technology, and science. She's hung out with Tibetan monks in the Pacific Palisades, seen seahorses at the bottom of Alamitos Bay, and spent time with the working witches of Los Angeles. She's always looking for a good story. I love that kind of wandering beat to beat, you know, meaning newspaper beats, but it's also that beat generation idea of always seeking, of always looking for the characters who will make life more interesting and fulfilling. And it seems rare in the modern news business, what's left of it anyway, where people tend to make their one beat their whole life and their whole personality. Biology Brenda on Twitter, or Supreme Court Susie, Aerospace Andy, who has a TikTok channel, is very popular, I guess. And your path reminds me of the old days when newspaper beats were an intense and temporary education. You'd have total immersion into the police beat or education or environmental issues, agriculture, the military base, whatever was in your area. And then you move onward when you get comfortable, and then you do it again in a new beat. Was that on purpose for you?
I'm not sure it was on purpose, but it is suited to my personality. I always wanted to be a religion reporter because that's what I'm really most interested in. But I couldn't get anyone to give me a job doing that. And so I first got hired in entertainment, and I thought, I don't want to write about this, but I can't help but get curious about whatever it is I'm writing about. And then they moved me to the home and garden section, and I thought, I don't want to do this. And then it turned out I could write about plants all day. You know, that was really fun too. And then they moved me to national news, and then they moved me to technology, which really seemed crazy. But I think being a curious person, I just think I'm inclined to be more kind of beginner's mind than an expert. But the other thing I'll say is that Biology Brenda, that's a brand. And so many journalists kind of need to have brands today, I think, right, to make it work. And I'm not sure I really have a brand. Being at a general newspaper has made it possible for me to have the type of career I've had.
When did you move to the religion and spirituality and joy beat?
I think it was 1 or 2 years ago. I can't remember. But it was definitely during the pandemic, I remember. And I'd been doing science for 7 years before that. And science was really cool because that's also a not beat. Everything is science. So I was always learning something new. It was awesome. But in the pandemic, it was just all COVID all the time. And at a certain point, I was like, I can't do this anymore. It was the summer of Delta.
I've noticed this tremendous gulf between mainstream news media, sort of consensus reality, and what real people actually believe in practice. And I see reporters, especially on social media, but also when they're talking, doing their MSNBC appearance or whatever, being just intolerably smug about religion and rituals and the occult and just total dismissal of people who work in those areas or people who have made that an important part of their life. There's a news story you wrote about tarot readers being targeted by Instagram scammers who make fake duplicate accounts and then go after a real person's followers and try to steal their income. And I read the story, and I know a lot of tarot readers, as you might expect with Desert Oracle. And it seemed like a worthwhile story on another way the internet criminals are targeting people trying to make a living, but that's not the response you got from readers.
Right. I took the people seriously, the tarot readers and the psychics seriously as people. And I believe that they feel they're helping their clients feel they're being helped. And that's like the definition of providing a service, right? I got so many emails from people threatening to cancel their subscription, offended that this would be in a national newspaper. Why wasn't I clear that the psychics themselves were scammers? I did not anticipate that level of vitriol at these, and they were all women, the people I wrote about. I didn't know people were so angry about them, because kind of in my world and sphere, I know tons of people that get their tarot read, their astrology chart done, and I just didn't know there was just this anger about it. And it really made me think about what these women are doing and what they're subjecting themselves to by being public.
This reminds me of the witch trials. That surprises me that still exists in a place like Los Angeles.
Right. I know. I agree. Although I also think that maybe people that believe in the esoteric kind of mystical way of seeing the world, maybe they don't see themselves reflected in the LA Times, so they're not who's reading it anymore. Does that make sense? And then it's kind of like this other type of person that is our reader. And so that's where that anger comes from.
Did you get anything like that with some of the other witch stories you've done? Two we were talking about before. One has the headline, "This Feminist Witch Introduced California to Goddess Worship." I think that would get you called a Satanist on Twitter today, just saying those words. This was about Susanna Budapest. Tell me about her.
Oh, she's amazing. She was this refugee who had come to the U.S. after World War II and then was living like as a housewife in Long Island. And then I think her husband was on vacation with his mistress or something, and she was like 30, and she just had it. She hitchhiked across the country to California, where she became a really out lesbian and started goddess worship. And you know, she's really kind of the inventor of modern American goddess worship. I can't believe I had the honor of meeting someone like that. And she'd host these big LSD-fueled women-only parties on the full moon in Malibu. She was really doing it. You know what I mean? She was really doing it. And then she did have a witch trial because she got arrested for reading tarot cards at her, you know, witch shop. I think it was in Venice. And most people just kind of paid the fine and went back to doing what they were doing, but she refused. And there was this big public trial. The LA Times was covering it daily. And she was calling it the first public witch trial in America in like 100 years or something like that.
When did this happen?
I'm sorry, I can't remember. I think it was early 70s. I think it was like 72 or something.
So the modern era, and LA County still had anti-witchcraft laws?
Yeah. Specifically I think it was anti-tarot reading. But yeah, you could get arrested for that. And that was finally overturned. She was like part of the case to get it overturned, but there was a different case that I think in the 80s. It wasn't until the 80s when you were allowed to give a tarot reading legally. And it was like a Romani person, I think, who finally won that case. I did not realize that it was illegal. Her name's Zsuzsanna Budapest, but she went
Zsuzsanna,
by Z.
Sorry.
Yeah, but she went by Z because most people couldn't pronounce the Zsuzsanna part. So Z Budapest, and she was like such a showman, you know, so she really was very theatrical, like the whole situation. And I kind of got the feeling like she was loving it. She's really playing it up, but she said it took a really big toll on her. And she left Los Angeles for San Francisco pretty soon after the trial was over.
And that was a time when Los Angeles still had a reputation for a pretty reactionary right-wing government and police. Well, still has the police reputation, and San Francisco was where all the public occultists seemed to be going, even though it never went away in Los Angeles. And we have all these, I guess you could call them New Age or alternative or Eastern temples and societies, from Philosophical Research Society in Los Feliz to the various temples at Line Sunset and Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, I always say that like LA's reputation as the New Age capital, I think, is really well earned. You know, we've got a really rich history. LA is the most spiritually diverse city in the world. And so that's all forms of worship and belief systems. So it's a great city for me to be doing the kind of work I'm doing right now.
What became of Z Budapest? Did she stay in San Francisco? Did she keep doing these witch sabbats? Or
she stayed in San Francisco for decades, and she wrote a lot of books, a ton of books. I think she had like a radio show actually up there.
I want to read this paragraph from the story on Z Budapest. And I'll put links up to these stories on the Desert Oracle Radio blog. She publicly hexed murderers and rapists. She wrote 13 books on ritual and witchcraft and founded the long-running International Goddess Festival, a biennial gathering of women in the California Redwoods that continues to this day. That's a great resume.
Oh, yeah. She's really impressive. Have you ever spent time with people who've really lived like an enormous life, but then they're like 83 and they're just, oh, these are my favorite cookies from the grocery store. You know what I mean? Like, it was like big and small at the same time when I met her.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Because life goes on.
Right.
And these big wild moments, they're great when you collect them in a story. That's what storytellers do. But you still have to deal with the normal banality of life. You get old, you have to find a retirement place, you got to find a place to put your cauldron. You know, there might be homeowners association rules. You probably can't do that sage smudging as much as you like because the smoke alarm keeps going off and the security guards come.
Yeah, I mean, COVID, she put together a coven at the, I don't think it was retirement village people. I think it was kind of other people in the vicinity. But, you know, COVID put a damper on the coven. So she was kind of lonely when I met her. And, you know, just to think of this person who had just influenced so many people and inspired so many people and doing chair yoga. You know what I mean? It was just really, it was interesting. She was really interesting.
And this is a worthwhile thing to mention because I find that there's some momentous event in many of these people's lives, in the lives of people who are outliers, trendsetters, who are moving from social revolution to social revolution. She was part of the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, learned in your story. And so she had to flee Hungary.
Yeah. When I was with her, it really was interesting. Because, like, she also, you know, her energy was high, but then she kind of crashed and she'd get really tired. And we watched these Hungarian folk dances together on YouTube. I think that's, like, really calming and relaxing to her to watch these folk dances. And they really tell a story, and they're really about courtship, and she's really attached to her Hungarian roots too. Even the name Zsuzsanna Budapest, that was like a signal that she had come up with her parents to when she left Hungary to let them know that she was okay.
You did another story. This one goes back to 2019, where you interviewed a bunch of, and I love the phrase, working witches in LA. How did you narrow it down to working witches? How did you find them?
I was subscribed to the Oracle of Los Angeles. I have an affinity for the word oracle.
Apparently.
I think I subscribed to her newsletter or something, and it was like something she said where she was like, I'm doing this and this. Oh, the life of a working witch. I knew that that was what she identified as and what she said her job was. And then I just thought, what does that really mean? How are you actually making money working as a witch? And so then I went hunting for people who identify as witches, and that's how they make their living. And I had too many. I spent time with more than made it into the story, but I had to cut it down for space. But yeah, it's pretty amazing that can be a full-time job these days.
It takes the place of a lot of traditional clergy that's not available anymore.
Over the years, I get calls from friends who, like, something's happened and they feel like they need to symbolically deal with it, but they don't know how to do it on their own. And they ask if I know someone who can help them. So, like, you know, I know someone who was in a lawsuit for years, and he, you know, it's finally over, but he's just like so much anger, and he feels like this person's haunting him. And so his wife called and was like, do you know like a witch who can maybe just help him? There's a really good quote in that story. It's when the Oracle of Los Angeles talks about how magic works. And it's like, yeah, we'll do the spell, we'll light the candle, and then we get to work. You know, so it's like, you know, they're not like, oh, abracadabra, I waved a wand and now you're healed or anything. But it's like, we're going to do something symbolic, and then now you have a task to do. That speaks to me personally.
Yeah. Here's the quote, I think. It says, and this is from the Oracle of Los Angeles. it's not like you wiggle your nose and your life is completely different. We work incrementally. If you want to win a Grammy, but you haven't written a song yet, we have a lot of work to do.
That's right. That to me is exactly what magic is about.
It has to have a way to happen.
Right. We're not defying the laws of nature. Magic doesn't defy the laws of nature and science. But, you know, it's like a kind of enchanted way of seeing the world. And I think it's more fun. To me, it's more fun to see the world that way.
And what age have we been in since the Industrial Revolution? The age of disenchantment.
Yes. Do you think you're turning a corner?
Yes.
I do too.
From Amboy to Zizix and across the great Mojave Wilderness, you have been listening to Desert Oracle Radio with musical soundscapes by our own Red, Blue, Black, Silver. I'm your host, Ken Lane. One night, we're going to get this show live on the radio every night. Wouldn't that be beautiful? Maybe Thursdays through Sundays, ideal for your desert road trips. There's got to be a desperate radio station owner or program director looking at a zero audience AM night signal blasting out of Vegas or Albuquerque or Tucson or wherever. Drop me a line. Let's talk. I need a change. Radio@DesertOracle.com. Go to DesertOracle.com to support this program on our Patreon account and order a subscription to our pocket-sized periodical. Issue number 10 is out now, or choose number 11 to get the autumn issue. Thanks for listening. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
I've been traveling, collecting people's stories. Here's one from Mo, a tour boat pilot at Glacier National Park.
Okay, so this was last season. It was one of my first solo hikes that I'd ever done in Glacier, and I decided to do it at sunrise. And I was coming up and over this mountain pass right at sunrise, and there was fog that was hanging low in this kind of U-shaped valley. And I remember there were three distinct bright orange rays that were breaking through the clouds and shining out over to like the west side of the park. And it was so beautiful. And I stood there for a moment just trying to take it all in, because at first I got too caught up in making it back on time and hiking fast enough. But I paused for a moment, and as I was pausing, I saw a little mountain goat that was around the corner just doing his thing. He didn't pay any attention to me. And then I heard the little pikas that are coming out of the rocks. And as I was sitting there being really still, I hadn't seen a pika in the park at all yet. They're those small little, I don't know if you know what a pika is, small little mouse-like things, but they're way cuter than mice. And I'd been wanting to see one, and I saw about three of them that started to just squeak from the rocks. And I just stood there silent and just observed them, and it was just one of the most beautiful moments I've ever had by myself in the park, and when I first fell in love with the park, for sure.
Thank you, Gallatin Valley, for listening. As always, you can call me and leave a message about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. Remember to spread the word that you can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. Well, that's it for today. So till next time, listeners, be safe, stay well, and sweet dreams. Beloved Mountain is taking us out with some doodling on his guitar strings here at the cabin.